You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 129. I have the need for speed. Maverick, Top Gun.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Now, guys, today on the show, we have... I'm just like kind of giddy. I'm really excited about this because we have on the show screenwriter Jack Epps Jr. Now, Jack is responsible for many of the films that I absolutely adored in the 80s and 90s. And the main film that pretty much got him his start, which also started the career of a little known actor by the name of Tom Cruise, which was Top Gun. He not only co-wrote Top Gun with his writing partner Jim Cash, he also wrote blockbuster films like Legal Eagles with Robert Redford, The Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox, Turner and Hooch with Tom Hanks, Dick Tracy with Warren Beatty, and Anaconda with J-Lo and Ice Cube, just to name a few. He also did extensive rewrites on the films Sister Act and Die Hard 3. I mean, Jack had a run in Hollywood that was unprecedented. It was hit after hit after hit after hit for many, many years. And in this conversation, we go deep into how Top Gun was even created, the stories behind Dick Tracy and Secret of My Success and many of his films, Turner and Hooch and so many others. But we also go into his book that he wrote, Screenwriting is Rewriting, The Art and Craft of Revisions. And it is a fantastic book because writing is rewriting. You write that first draft, then you go back and rewrite and refine. And that process is not something that is taught very often. It's only about getting that first draft done, but the rewriting process, it is super, super important. And he is definitely someone who can teach you the art and craft of rewriting. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jack Epps Jr. I'd like to welcome to the show Jack Epps Jr. How are you doing, Jack?
I'm doing really well. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to kind of get into the weeds about your career because you've written some classic 80s and 90s films that I grew up with. And again, the audience will get tired of me saying this, but you had an impact on my video store days when I was working at the video store. years.
Very nice. Those were great days. I love videos.
No, those were like the great
days. Candy show.
Exactly. So all of your films and your especially in the 80s and early 90s, all the stuff that you wrote was like I was there moving the boxes. recommending them to the customers coming in. So let me ask you, how did you get started in the business?
Well, you know, it's one of those sort of long stories in the sense of I became interested in film as an undergraduate at Michigan State University. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. Moved out to California because I just fell in love with movies, and I said, this is what I want to do with my life. I actually came out to California to be a director because I was making short films, had no money, virtually no contacts, and the best way to direct was on paper and started writing. And through a friend I met at Michigan State, Anderson House, his dad knew the producer of Hawaii Five-O and said if we wrote a treatment, he could get it to him. So we actually put together a treatment called The Capsule Kidnapping, sent it to his dad, who sent it to the Phil Leacock, who sent it to the showrunner, who then called us and said, we love this idea. So quickly I sold it. Yeah, exactly. So we sold the script and had a Hawaii Five-O produced very, very quickly. I mean, and then we worked together for a couple of years trying to get other things produced, and we sold a Kojak and things like that, but didn't really move forward a lot. At the same time, I had to pay rent. And so because I was a filmmaker, I was actually an assistant cameraman. Mm. And so doing a lot of work on stuff like that. I actually worked for Orson Welles on The Other Side of the Wind.
What was that like?
You know, it was really great because there's Orson Welles. The story of how it happened is my wife was my girlfriend at the time. She was working as a typist. And so she got a call from her temp agency and said, Orson Welles needs somebody. And she was from Peoria, not a film family. So she goes, Orson Welles, I know the name. I said, don't worry, just go meet him. Because I knew the less she would know, the more he would like her. And so he hired her. And then I said, you got to get me on this film. So I spent a couple months with Orson and Gary Graver and it was great because it's Orson Welles. Really nice. I mean, he didn't throw any temper tantrum. He wasn't like this big. He was just Orson Welles, and there's the guy. And you know, so I'm pitching myself. Like I said, I cannot believe I'm pulling focus on Orson Welles here.
That's amazing. And that booming voice that he has. And
the whole persona.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That must have been amazing. And everyone listening, when you're starting off as a screenwriter, generally it works out that you write a spec pilot for a hit television show, and it gets picked up right away. And then you start making lots of money just like yourself, correct?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Well, you know, but what happened is I then my college screenwriting teacher, Jim Cash, had contacted me and said we should write together. And so Jim and I went back to Michigan to pick up my motorcycle to drive back to California. I looked him up. We sat down at the school union and we pitched out 8 ideas. I didn't think anything worked. We said, thanks, goodbye. I was riding back cross country and I said, you know, this idea actually works. And Jim and I spent the next 2 years doing about 5 different drafts and figuring out how to write together long distance because he was in East Lansing and I was in Santa Monica. We wrote a script finally that I felt was ready to take it to go into the business to let out mm-hmm. because I had learned enough through internships and things to know that you really have to enter the business at a high level. The script mm-hmm. has to be very, very a good read. It's got to be a good story and show off your work as writers and storytellers. And that script was called Izzy and Mo. And we got representation at a major agency through a friend who recommended us. And it got optioned by Bud Yorkin of Yorkin and Lear. And so suddenly we were paid some pretty good option money that made both of us say, we should stay at this. So we were lucky that our first spec actually got optioned.
Yeah, right. A lot of screenwriters think that just because you get optioned, that's an automatic production. And that's not the case at all. Most option scripts don't get into production. Is that a fair statement?
Well, it is the truth. I mean, it's what it does is one, it puts it. So, yes, no, Izzy and Mo never got made. Bud Yorkin, who was at Yorkin and Lear, could not get it made. But what it did is it put us on a spotlight. People knew we were there. And then we did a second script, a second spec script, which was called Old Gold. And that was a sort of a charm and chase adventure set in San Francisco about a fortune hunter looking for lost gold from the Nazis that ended up in San Francisco. And then that got bought on an auction. And so we earned good money. I mean, so it was like, okay, this is now we're throwing ourselves into it. But that didn't get made.
I've spoken to so many screenwriters over the years and known many during my time in the business that sometimes you look at an IMDb filmography and you're like, oh, they've only done three movies. I'm like, yeah, but they've been working steadily for a decade. And just because they haven't been produced, I mean, they're still pulling in six figures a year and working on major projects that just either they're rewriting or polishing or script doctoring and don't get made. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely. And what I learned very quickly is that if a studio has a choice between their idea or your idea, they're always going with their idea. So why not develop their ideas, which they already invested in? And
smart.
The key is you have to turn it into your idea. You have to, you know, I have to make it, you've got to own it, but realize that you're writing for them and you want to make the producers and the studios happy. So we then started writing on assignment, we had six unproduced screenplays.
Wow.
And then, yeah, we did Dick Tracy for four directors. That got shelved. Wasn't getting made. We then, Simpson Bruckheimer, Jeff Katzenberg was involved in Dick Tracy because it was actually owned by Universal and Paramount. So it was a joint production. They had international and domestic rights. And so Jeff Katzenberg liked our work and wanted to hire us after Dick Tracy. And I had a breakfast meeting, the famous 8 a.m. breakfast meeting with Katzenberg. And he rolled out six ideas, of which I thought this really interesting idea stood out to me, based on this school of pilots called Top Gun. And I thought, wow. I actually got my private pilot's license at Michigan State. They had a flying club. So I thought, well, if the movie doesn't get made, I'll get to fly in a Navy jet. So, okay.
It's a win-win. It's a win-win.
Nothing's getting made. So why would this one get made? But flying a Navy jet, that's a hard thing to get to do.
Yeah, you've got to go through, you have to jump through a few hoops to get to that point in your life, to say the least.
Yeah,
So the original idea for Top Gun was Jeff Katzenberg kind of throughout the air, like, hey, there's a school of pilots, figure something out?
Well, actually, it was actually Jerry Bruckheimer.
Okay.
Jerry found an article in a California magazine based on that there was a school and there were these pilots and they were having fun. There was no story, no characters, but it was a potential world. And so Jerry brought it to, you know, the producer would do, brought it to, he was had a deal at Paramount with Don Simpson, and Paramount wanted to develop the idea. And so for us, it was like, okay, we had just finished Dick Tracy and that was not going into production. And so here's
and, what year, and what year, this is 84, 85 for Dick Tracy?
Actually, Dick Tracy was actually in the early 80s.
Right.
I went through four directors on that project.
We'll get to Dick Tracy in a little bit down the line. Right. But with Top Gun, so you're basically on assignment, essentially. You got Absolutely. It was an open assignment. Jerry came up with the concept of just the world, right. And you guys came up with Maverick and Iceman and the whole thing. I mean, so when you're writing this, it's another assignment. You're like, this is not going to get made, but hell, we'll have some fun. And we're getting paid to do it. So you didn't think it was, did you have any idea that it was actually going to go into production? Did you feel something?
Well, so basically, Simpson Bruckheimer, when I met with him, I said, look, guys, I don't want to do this unless we can actually get the planes. Like, I really don't want to have these like little, you know, CGI is not what it is today.
Right.
Okay, today you can pull it off, but then you could not. And so they agreed. We went back to the Pentagon. We got approval by the Pentagon. They gave me a technical advisor by the name of Pete Pettigrew. I went to down at the NAS Miramar, and I got to fly jets. And the
were
whole
you
time
in the,
I was
– Did you were in the back like you were the
– Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
no,
my
absolutely.
God. And that's amazing.
A couple of things happened. One is the F-14. Mm-hmm. Wow. I fell in love with the plane. I really didn't know about military planes at that time. And I fell in love with it for two reasons. One, it looks incredibly cool on the ground. It's like, wow, this thing is just the fastest, most beautiful thing ever designed. And two, it had two people flying in it, a front seater and a back seater. And I didn't really know about that. And that gave me a relationship.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I already went, yes, I don't have to have guys going from plane to going, hi, Maverick, how you doing? And then cut to, hi, how are you? So I can actually have these two people and form a relationship, which gave me a core to develop in the story. So I said, great, we've got a relationship. But I'm looking for all the guys there are great, get along, and I'm going for, where's the conflict? What am I writing here? I've got to look for the conflict. And then it came to me like one of those bolts of thunder. I went, lightning is, what if one guy doesn't get along? What happens if you got a guy who sticks out like a sore thumb? What happens to this environment? Maverick is born. So I had the conflict. And then we just start building out the story from there in a sense. And I pitched to Don and Jerry. I said, look, we're going to do a school movie, but it's got to have a real fight in the end, guys. We're not going to have a school. He said, yeah, like Star Wars at the end. Absolutely. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do a big fight. Star Wars fight scene at the end. Big dog fights for real stakes at the end. So I did all this research. Simpson and Bruckheimer are great. I said, look, guys, you got to leave us alone. Just let us go away. We're going to have to find the story. I can't pitch it to you. You got to trust us. And if you don't want to trust us, get somebody else, because we just can't go through this development process. We have to find it. And they were great. They said, guys, go away. And then afterwards, I said, we'll never do that again. But so we were able to just find the story, you know, and that was a hard story to find because it's set in a school. It's a school of guys flying around. Why are you there? And so for us, that breaking that story, finding what was and who those characters were in the relationships and what the drama of it was of that story.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, you know, Top Gun's a classic film. And you know, I've seen it a million times, but that whole movie is all about character. It's like the plot moves things along, but it is about character so heavily, as opposed to like a Sherlock Holmes story, which is all plot and character kind of rides along. Would you agree? I mean, this is Iceman and Maverick and his interest and his father and that baggage that he's carrying and the conflict between him and Iceman, which is just amazing. and we'll talk about all the stars aligning in a minute. But as far as the characters, do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's why we couldn't pitch it. It's almost an unpitchable script, because it's like, well, what happens? It's like, because so much came out of the research. I did about 40 hours worth of interviews with pilots. At first, the Pentagon had an assistant in there with me and they wouldn't talk. And I said, look, you got to get out. I'm sorry. I got to talk to these guys alone. And they, no, I won't. And then they called the Pentagon and said, yeah, leave them alone. And then the guys opened up and you know, learned about their lives and met these guys. So they were inspiring as people. But also, Jim and I were athletes. So we knew what it meant to be on a team and to try to make sure you're, you know, the sense of being, you know, one of the stars on the team. You know, you got to be the best, you know, that's part of what sort of the drive for excellence is. But it's a long way to get to your question. We handed in the script. Simpson and Bruckheimer loved it. They loved this movie. But Paramount said, I don't get it. I won't see the movie.
Of course they did. Of course they did.
All these planes in the sky. It's like this. So they said no. And they put it on a shelf. So there's number 7 unproduced motion picture. And so we thought we had something. We believed in it. And so did Simpson Bruckheimer, but not going to happen. So we went on to our next project, Legal Eagles with Ivan Reitman.
Not a bad other project.
Not a bad thing. And Ivan was great. And it wasn't until the studio changed, the executives, the new executives came in. Frank Mancuso, who called Simpson Bruckheimer and said, guys, we have nothing in the cupboards. Do you have anything you want to make? And they pulled the script down and said, yeah, we got this project we'd like to make. And they said, go do it.
It's just like that. And then what I find so fascinating about that film specifically is it was a perfect alignment where Jerry and Don were coming up. They had already started building from Flashdance, I think it was, and probably a little bit before, but they started to build, but they weren't yet Jerry and they weren't Bruckheimer Simpson completely yet. They had, Top Gun is what took them to the next level. So you have young producers who are about to explode. They bring in a commercial director who had done one other, I think he did, what did he do? What was the other film that he did? Hunger. The Hunger. So a vampire film. And brought him in. And then this young actor who had success with Risky Business, but yet wasn't Tom Cruise. All of these things aligned and it exploded into this supernova, essentially. And that movie was a massive, wasn't around at that time, it was a massive hit and one of the best recruitment tools the Navy has ever had and probably still has to this day.
We wrote the movie for Tom.
Yeah.
We wrote it with him in mind from the very beginning.
Wow.
And when he gave the script to Don and Jerry, I said to Jerry, think Tom Cruise when you read this. And they said, yep, absolutely. And that was the only person that they really? Went after Tom. Yeah.
But he had the likability factors.
Part of it was because the character, Maverick is a bit of a jerk. And so he's really arrogant. So you've got to have an actor that you're going to like, that you're going to stay with,
mm-hmm.
or else you're just going to go, F this guy, I'm out of here. And Tom did that. He was the young American, so to speak. And he represented that sort of this bravado and, pushing it at the limit and they nailed him. They got him. And he was great. He understood it. And he's played Maverick for the rest of his career.
it's Top Gun in the car and Top Gun. Yeah. He developed who Tom Cruise is in Top Gun basically. Yes. And I remember some comedians like, I love that movie with Tom Cruise, but he's a young cocky white guy. Oh, you mean every movie? Got it. Okay, got it. All right, great. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. But to be fair though, that is a very slippery slope as an actor and a character to play because you're right. He's arrogant as hell, but yet for some reason you love him. What do you think about Maverick's character? Is it partly how it's written and obviously how Tom performed it? But I think there was meat in the script that allowed you to feel empathy towards him. And I think it might be the father baggage that you kind of, because if you don't add that baggage, I don't think he's as, there's no empathy there. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's all part of the story. And part of it, we made him a second chance character. He was the underdog. Remember, he wasn't going first. He had to win a cougar had to hand in his wings for him to get in. So he was always the underdog. And we tend to root for underdogs. And Iceman, of course, immediately is a great counterpart. And the rivalry makes you root for Tom. You want him to stick in Iceman's face and you're rooting for him. You also feel for him. He wants to do it right. He's got some stuff he's got to work out. Hopefully he can work it out.
Right. And but at the end of the day, he's a good guy trying to do good work. And, he's trying to be all you can be, as they say.
Yeah. Well, he's got some things to learn.
Yeah, no question. And I mean, how were you excited to know that they were making the sequel?
Yeah, I was excited. And I was happy that one, Tom's involved and Jerry's doing it because Jerry will be true to the movie. And I know that he'll keep the continuity going with that. So I think, I'm excited to see it. I've read it. I know what they've done. I can't talk about it because they don't want any talk about it. But I think people will like it because it is a continuation.
It's a true sequel. It's a true sequel.
Yeah, it is. It's a continuation. It's not just a different movie. It's the characters come back and there's growth and development.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Now, so you already, are you already working on League Legals before Top Gun gets into production?
Yes. So we went from having 7 unproduced screenplays to 3 films in production in 11 months.
Jesus, that's unheard of.
It was insane. It was insane because suddenly you have Top Gun's in production, League Legals in production, Secret My Success is in production.
Jesus. So, and for people, again, that weren't around at the time, Legal Eagles was starred, obviously, Robert Redford, Daryl Hannah, and Deborah Winger. That was a massive hit. And then Secret of My Success, which, by the way, personally, one of my favorite 80s films of all time. I watched that when I was a kid. I must have watched that story in that film 100 times because I was Michael J. Fox. I wanted to, It was during the Wall Street day. So yeah, I wanted to make it in business and all of that kind of stuff. And it was just such a wonderful film. And that was a huge hit. That was a massive hit as well. It was Michael J. Fox at the peak of his powers.
Yeah, right after Back to the Future 1. And he was great. I mean, Michael was fabulous. We wrote it for him. We were brought into a rewrite. Mm-hmm. So basically, it was a screenwriter's dream. Frank Price, who was the executive of Universal, knew us well, liked our work. I pitched them an idea. And they said, what if we took that idea and put it into this movie we have? It wasn't called Secret of My Success at that time, something else. And I said, yeah, sure. So we did a page one and just went through the whole script. But what was great is they said, we have to start on June 1st because we have Michael J. Fox, and then we have to end by August something because he's going back to his show, Family Ties.
Oh, yeah.
And so they had to shoot what we wrote.
Oh, so there was no chances to rewrite. So it was perfect for you guys.
Exactly. So we just buzzed through it, had a great time. And really, you know, knowing you're writing for Michael J. Fox gives you a lot of fun in the script. And we also wanted to not demonize business as it always is, but as you were saying, people with ambition and that character having, you know, coming to want to make his place in the world. Mm-hmm. And also I wanted to do I'm a big Billy Wilder fan, and wanted to do a character who's assuming an identity. So a guy who's playing two identities. I always want to work that. And that's really difficult to write that. But it was fun. There was a lot of fun to do it. And we were really pleased with the outcome. And Herb Ross, who was the director, was a Broadway director. So he liked the words. He wasn't one. If you're Broadway director, you direct the words. And he wasn't playing with them and was really just going for it. And I thought the movie really worked out well.
Now, with those three films, I mean, it's kind of unheard of for a screenwriting team, a writer, screenwriters in general, to have that many hits back to back to back in such short amount of time as well. How did the town treat you? I mean, after Top Gun alone, I mean, I'm sure your phone was ringing off the hook at that point.
Well, as my agent would say at that time, don't ask, they're not available. So
everybody was reaching out to you at that point. You were the bell of the ball, as I like to say.
Right. It was that stuff. And because we knew Katzenberg and liked him, we worked at Disney, worked on Sister Act. You know, we did a major rewrite on that, Turner and Hooch. You know, Jim didn't want to write Top Gun originally because he didn't like planes. He didn't like flying planes. So he had a phobia. I said, don't worry about it. We'll do it. So he did it for me. And then he wanted to do Turner and Hooch because it's a, you know, he has dogs. He had like four dogs. And he's, I want to write a dog movie. He's, okay, I owe you one. So we sort of traded off. Things just came our way. And so it was fun. It was different because when we were unknown, people left us alone. And the more known you got, the more everybody's looking over your shoulder. And that was a very different experience in terms of just how that had changed a little bit.
And for people listening, especially young screenwriters coming up, I mean, yeah, you had a lot of success in a short amount of time, but you had been putting in the years of work prior to that. Like you said, there was six unproduced screenplays. Yeah, you had representation. Yeah, you'd optioned a few things. But you had been, it's not like you just woke up one morning and like, oh, here's Top Gun. Like it took you years to get to that place. And I think screenwriters, young screenwriters need to understand that you've got to put in the work and it's not going to happen overnight.
I think we were actually fortunate that we didn't get our first movies produced. I think we wouldn't have grown as writers. No, I mean,
yeah, you're right.
I think we would have tapped ourselves in the back and saying how brilliant we were. And we would have been very happy at that level. And, you know, our first movies are fine. They're good reads. But we had to grow and we had to work harder and dig deeper to basically teach ourselves how, you know, just because everyone's trying to figure out how does this thing work? And the more and more we got to character was really, really the breakthrough. You know, telling stories about people, lives in crisis, you know, rewriting is a big part of what Jim and I did together. And it, you know, we just realized you had to dig in. I mean, like I said, for Dick Tracy, we went through four directors and for each director, we did two drafts.
Now, so let's jump into Dick Tracy really quickly. So I remember 1990 very well. It was right smack in the middle of my video store days. So it was in the heat, and that was Dick Tracy, I think, and please correct me wrong. This is my assumption. Dick Tracy got greenlit and got fast tracked into production after Batman. Came out in 1989 because that kind of just changed the landscape. All of a sudden, superhero movies were it, because prior to Batman, for people not understanding, because now every week there's a new Batman or Superman or Marvel film coming out.
Exactly.
There was a time. There was a time where there was one, maybe, and it took every 2-3 years before you'd get one or something like that. Before Batman, there was Superman, and Superman had pretty much pitted off after Donner left. So when Batman came out, which was a absolute insane massive hit, Dick Tracy showed up, and then Dick Tracy. Watching it, I mean, it had Danny Elfman's music. So it had a lot of tonality from Batman. Mm-hmm. It was a dark Dick Tracy. It was, you know, the world was so, it was, by the way, just so beautifully constructed, and the colors were so vibrant, and the performance. I mean, you had, look at the cast, Madonna, Al Pacino, William Forsythe, and Warren Beatty. It's just amazing. Am I correct in saying that that was the reason why I got fast-tracked?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was the at that point looking for something to the big superhero type movie like that, and it was ready to go. The script is ready, and Warren, people saw him as the only. That was one of the problems getting that movie made, is that Warren was who everybody saw as Dick Tracy. There was nobody else. And that becomes a problem because, well, we only make it with Warren. And when we first started the script with John Landis, who for my business would have been probably the most interesting, wacky, crazy Dick Tracy. Mm-hmm. John had that terrible Twilight Zone accident. He exited. Then we got Walter Hill, who taught me a lot. Walter was a screenwriter, editor, a good director.
Yeah.
And he basically taught us a lot. He, you know, it was funny because we're a little arrogant, you know. Hey, we've been doing really well, and Walter asked us to do a fix on the script, and we pushed back. Said, "No, we don't want to do this." And he said, "Well, okay, I'll do it. I'll write it. Don't worry about it." And we went, "Oh, hold on a second here. You know, that's not a bad idea. We'll do it because you don't want the director writing. You want to stay the writer." So we said, "Oh, I think I understand what you mean." So, you know, Walter taught us a lot, you know, how to hang in the game and also how to focus the characters well. I mean, you know. And then Walter, as I understand the story, he talked to Warren, and Warren said, "Can I watch the dailies?" And Walter said, "No, I never let actors watch dailies." And Warren said, "Thank you, gone." Movie crashes. Dick Benjamin comes on to do a cheap version of Dick Tracy. We cut the script down for budget. That doesn't happen. And then Warren ends up, after a couple of years of languishing, walking in over to Paramount and getting the rights and moving the rights to Disney. And then once he's on board and he's directing, we met, you know, Warren and I met and talked, and he's a good director. You know what I mean? Yeah. So he was, "Should I direct this?" I said, "Absolutely." You know, who would do it better than you?
Yeah. And it was, I think people wanted it to be the next Batman, and it was a hit. It did do good business, right?
It did good business. It wasn't quite what everyone wanted it to be. It didn't get that super numbers in there. There was a lot of things crammed into that movie. You got Stephen Sondheim's songs. You can't complain about that, but they took up a lot of space. It became a bit of a musical, you know.
Well, fact, Madonna's in it.
Yeah, I'm surprised no one's done Dick Tracy the musical so far, since it would work.
Yeah, and Madonna was at the height of her powers as well, so they had to put – there has to be a couple of, you know, song and dance numbers with Madonna in it, because that's why we're hiring her. So, and that's the other thing that screenwriters and filmmakers sometimes don't understand, is that there's just politics involved here. There's a lot of politics involved, and there's a lot of not only egos but, you know, agendas that need to be crammed. Like you said, a lot of things were crammed in because there was so much pressure on that film. I'm surprised that it did as well as it did because of the amount of pressure. They were hoping for another Batman. And that's you know, lightning in a bottle. It doesn't happen very often. And it was still good enough that it did do good business, but obviously didn't, you know, break out into what Batman was. But it still holds up very well today. I watched it the other day. It still holds up very well.
Well, the look is great. Richard Silbert did amazing art direction. Let's say the colors. And Warren was working to create a sort of a comic book structure. If you look at it, the setups are almost like it's by panels, a comic panel. he was trying to do that specifically. You've got great roles with Dustin Hoffman doing Mumbles.
Oh, yeah. I forgot Dustin. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I know. He called in everybody to come in and do this little stuff.
Exactly. He's just like, hey, can you just come down and do this character for us, please? But when you're Warren Beatty, you could do things like that. Now, but I have to ask you, though, how did you convert or adapt a comic strip to a feature film? I mean, it's not like a comic book, if I'm not mistaken, right? It was mostly comic strips, right? There wasn't like this.
It was all comic strips.
Yeah, it was just comic strips like you would read in the Sunday paper. So how do you take that and adapt it into a major motion picture?
I'm a big believer in research. I did a lot of research on Top Gun, Secret of My Success. We had a technical advisor for business, so I could ask him questions about business because I didn't want to make stuff up. I wanted to, so I could put, totally could feel like it's based on something. For Dick Tracy, I asked Universal, can you get me all the comic strips that Chester Gould wrote? Like, can you get them? And they got me from 1932, the first one, all the way up into the mid-50s. And so I sat down and read it like a book. I just literally read every comic strip, and I fell in love. I want to understand Chester Gould's writing style, his intention, his storytelling. I want to know his characters, because I had to be true to this. And I was not the fan of the strip that Jim was, but I became a huge fan of Chester Gould, the creator, because he created all these wonderful characters. And I fell in love with characters, all his Gould's characters, and my favorite being the blank. I just thought the blank was so interesting. So it's like, okay, we're going to construct our own story, because I can't do it. None of the strip stories would work, but I can take the characters. And at the very beginning, John Landis said he wanted this set around Big Boy Caprice in the roaring 30s, so to speak, 20s, 30s. And so that was our original walking orders. That Big Boy Caprice is the center of the story. So we had to figure out, okay, what can we do? And then once I found the blank, I said, okay, now I've got a character I love. Let's figure out what the story is. And we started building that out with the blank at the center of the mystery. And then telling basically a prohibition style type story, and which was sort of fun, you know, those tropes and reach out and do those things.
And the funny thing is now that, Dick Tracy always used to speak into his watch, and now we speak into our watch.
Exactly.
It was pretty, it's taken, I think that was even part of the Apple ad campaign. They put a little bit of Dick Tracy in there. I think it was the Warren shot of him talking into it as part of the, that's part of the ads. When you did Legal Eagles, you worked with Ivan Reitman, who's, a legend in our business. What was it like working with Ivan? And it was Ivan right after Ghostbusters. So he was on fire and fuego, as they say.
Well, part of that was that our agent was frustrated, too, that we didn't get anything made. We didn't get Top Gun produced. So he said, look, I'm going to put you with Ivan Reitman because they'll make anything he wants to make. At that point, Ivan was the hottest director in the world. And so he had this, it was his idea. He wanted to do a thing about the art world and wanted to do sort of a romantic comedy set in the art world. And so it was up for us to, once again, figure out, what's the story? Who are the people? It's like, okay, that's the assignment. Now let's go figure out what it is. So again, I went to New York, went to the Pace Gallery, interviewed people, just to figure out the environment of building out the story. He did originally, this is one of the funny things. Originally, he wanted to take the characters from Tootsie, the Dustin Hoffman, Bill Murray characters, and that was the original cast idea, and wanted to put them, build a movie around those guys. A whole different story, but that's where we got the district attorney, and then we got the Fleabag sort of guy, which gives us the relationship that Ivan wanted to explore. Well, we had half a script. He said, look, I can't wait. I got to send it to these guys. They won't sit around and wait. Ivan, it's a half a script. No, just give it to me now. So, yes, sir. So I sent him a half a script. I sent it to Dustin. Well, Warren had just, talked him into doing, what's that crazy movie where, that horrible film.
Which one? God. Ishtar.
Ishtar. Yeah, Ishtar, right. See, tossed him into doing Ishtar. So Dustin wasn't available. And Bill Murray said, I hate attorneys. I'll never play an attorney in my life. So suddenly that idea crashed. We've got half the script. So Ivan goes, what about a romantic comedy with Robert Redford? You think you could do that? I said, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, I can do that. So we got to fly in the Columbia plane out to St. George, Utah, meet with Bob. And hung out for a couple hours into that world and found out that he was you know, sort of a self-deprecating guy and made jokes about himself, sort of a clumsiness, which we, exactly. And we see that and said, well, Bob, I would love to make that as part of the character, which we did. So we wrote it with that sort of character. Although when he came to set, he wasn't quite thrilled to play that character. So we got a couple beats of him, you know, dancing to Singing in the Rain in his apartment, chewing on ice cream. So we got a couple of beats out of him that are sort of out of character, but not as far as we wanted to go.
Now, with the thing about Legal Eagles is, in those kind of films, I remember them so clearly, where it's a romantic comedy, but there is there's an action and there's like thriller-esque things, and like there's danger, there's like real danger. And I like remember like movies like Stakeout and those kind of, that kind of time period. Yeah. There were a lot of, they don't make these films anymore. They're not really made anymore, and they're so wonderful.
Yeah, they are wonderful. I mean, they get made as, you can make a thriller like that right now.
Right.
If you come up with a good idea, you throw it. But romantic comedies, well, Jim and I called them charm and chase movies.
Right.
We were really influenced by North by Northwest in the films of Alfred Hitchcock, Howard Hawks,
Sturgis.
You know, Preston Sturgis. And then these sort of big romantic comedies were something that we did well. But no, they don't make those anymore. And they sort of fell out of fashion. A lot of it has to do with the Apatow comedy and how that came in and changed the whole comic tone. Mm-hmm. And it just, they became dated in a sense. And I think that's why they've ended up on Lifetime and you don't see those movies anymore. It's sort of, comedy changes a lot.
Yeah.
And in comedy, and so those movies just sort of went away. I mean, you can still do the bigot action movies like that. You can do them in action and create that, the fun. I mean, I think that's what Tom's done in Mission Impossible. He's created that sense of that.
But those are mostly action with some humor, as opposed to romantic comedy with some really thriller-esque elements and real danger elements. But it is a romantic comedy. But yeah, action films with humor are, I mean, that goes.
Yeah,
I mean,
even
Beverly Hills Cop, you can argue it's more of a comedy than it is an action film, but it's pretty even keel as far as thriller and comedy it goes, without question. Now, when you start working on a script, do you outline?
Well, you know, the greatest piece of advice I got was from a writer. I was doing an internship on a movie called Hearts of the West with Jeff Bridges. Mm-hmm. And the writer was, and it was really great. Tony Bill gave me the job. I had 6 months, 3 months of pre-production, 3 months of production, which really showed me what a movie is. Not a screenplay, but here's what movies are. And Rob Thompson gave me a piece of advice. I was talking about how he does scripts and all this stuff. And he said, oh, I use the card method. I said, what? Yeah, I use index cards. I break each scene into an index card. And that was like a light bulb went in on my head and changed my life. Because from that moment on, I've been using index cards. So I beat out a story, not on an outline, because an outline to me, I don't start on page one. I don't start in the first scene. I start with scenes I like to see. So what is a scene I like to see? And then I'm going to look at that scene. It might be a middle scene, might be the ending scene. And so I don't work in any linear method. I basically start to visualize how I see the movie and start to fill in the pieces. Mm-hmm. And for me, that allows, and I also have to see my movie. If I'm doing an outline, I'm looking at one page. What's on page 4 or 5? So by laying it out on a big table, and I married the right woman, she allowed me to have the dining room table for 20 years filled with cards. We ate in the small table. And I movie is about 55 cards, something like that. But I go through literally hundreds of them trying to figure out the movie, and I replay them. And I use colored cards to code relationships. So the main character is the white card, and then different colored cards for the relationships to show, so I can track my relationships and subplots through the movie. But I'm able then to read them in columns and see my movie in one glance. I can sit down and I can, so before I work on a scene, I can get the beats, the character development, and I got a hole here. I can work on the hole and fix the hole. And I also can change cards around at will, because there's, you know, it takes a couple seconds to write a new card. There's no like resistance to making a change.
Right.
And when I feel I'm ready, I've got it, then I've got something to write.
Now, do you start with the scenes or plot, or do you start with the character first?
Good question. The two things I'm looking for is, one, what's the story? What's this about? What's the movie? What's the essence of it? And two, I'm always looking for where's the conflict in the story, because I learned early on you write the conflict. If I don't have the conflict, then I've got nothing to write. So, and then I'm looking for who lives in this world, who is a person, what is their story, what do they want, what are they trying to achieve, what I'm looking for, what are they pushing against, what's the antagonistic force, what's the opposition. So I'm trying to find whose story it is. I'm looking for major relationships. So I'm looking to build all these things and understand it before I start going to cards. So I have to pretty much know whose movie it is and what I'm trying to tell. And that's something that I work out well in advance of beginning to plot the movie.
Now,
so I pretty much know whose story it is.
Gotcha. Now,
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Another film that you did in that time period, which I literally just watched with my daughters, who are young, Turner and Hooch. And
I'm sorry. I always apologize because I held back from showing to my kids until they were like 12 and 13. So because it's going to break their hearts.
So. It was like, so we watched it. And that was the other thing, too. And like, by the way, spoiler alert, something happens at the end. But the thing about that is that they were concerned about the ending when it was happening, because they were just like, oh my God, is he?
Yeah.
But the way you were able to just bring in that light at the end with the puppies was absolutely brilliant. Because I hadn't seen it since my video store days. I really hadn't watched it in a long time. Right. You know, like sat down and watched it all the way through. And my wife and I both were just looking at like, there's so much. And Tom Hanks in the 80s was just so brilliant. And that Hooch, oh my God, that dog was remarkable. How did Turner and Hooch show up? Because I know Tom loves to make jokes about this. He's like, yeah, I did the dog movie. I don't know why I did the dog movie. But he always jokes about it in interviews.
No. What Tom did say is when he accepted his Academy Award for Philadelphia, he thanked Hooch.
That's right. Exactly.
Teaching me a better actor.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
I know. Well, it was once again, we were working with Disney and Katzenberg. Yeah. This thing was going to production. And they literally didn't have things for Tom to play. Tom, you know, because what we became known as the guys to come in and bring character to it, bring story. I'm really good. We were good at fixing things. Like I can read the script and say, okay, I like this, but this, here's what it needs to make it a movie. And so that was, they had the dog, but we just doubled down on the world's messiest dog. And we doubled down on Tom being the world's cleanest guy and letting that sort of OCD character sort of, you know, be a problem for him and creating a love story and creating a relationship in there. So
conflict was in there just from the beginning.
Right. Absolutely. And also making you fall in love with Hooch is just this grisly. The worst thing that could happen to the character is the best thing that could happen to the character. And what was so much fun about that project is that Tom was involved in the development. So I would meet with the director and Tom would be there and he'd be throwing out lines. I'd be writing all these lines down. Thank you. No line down, you know. And the thing about Tom Hanks, he is who you think he is. Mm-hmm. He's a remarkable guy and great to work with, generous as can be. And it was just such a pleasure to have somebody like that in a development meeting, just helping develop the character. Because his concern was his relationship with Hooch. He wanted to make sure that relationship was solid because that's the core of the movie. And we worked on that.
Now, the one thing I really think is a learning moment here in the conversation is conflict and how perfectly, you know, Turner and Hooch, the conflict was self-evident. There's no working for the conflict. Like you just put two forces on complete opposite sides of the spectrum and you just threw them together in a room and it writes itself almost because of that. And I think that is something that screenwriters writing screenplays now or writing their stories. I've read so many screenplays and I've, been doing coverage and things like that where the conflict is almost forced. Like it's like, oh, I don't buy that. Like, oh, there's no motivation there. The bad guy has this motivation and the good guy has this motivation. And it's like really like convoluted. But the core of conflict from just something as simple as Turner and Hooch, it's built in. And I think if you're writing a story, having two characters who are just completely on two opposite sides of the spectrum without any major details, like it's very basic. I'm clean. You're dirty. Oh my God, we've got to live together. It's the Odd Couple with a dog and a guy. Yeah. Essentially, do we agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one thing I learned early in figuring out how to write and what screenplays are about is using relationships to produce conflict. And I'm a big believer in having multiple layers of conflict. I call them opposition forces. I want to make sure that my characters have a lot of opposition. And no matter where they turn throughout the story, there's a point of opposition there. And there are different degrees. It's not like it has to be everything's huge. It doesn't matter. The main character is going on a journey, and the journey is fraught with challenges of different degrees. And what that character is trying to do is get what they want, but ultimately what they need at the end. And in the process trying to get what they want, they bump into opposition characters and opposition situations, which helps define the character, because we see who is this character? Who is this person? Why do we root for them? What do we want? Are they, what's their growth arc through the story? And by using plot and relationship to help tell the story and create conflict, it allows me to explore the character from multiple points of view and allows a character to express themselves to different people in different ways depending upon the relationship. And then I'm a big believer in you don't want to rely on plot all the time. It's just plot. Because plot, I say, is curiosity. Oh, what's going to happen? But emotion is character. And character is about relationships. It's not no character exists by themselves. I mean, in Castaway, they had to create Wilson because he needed somebody to relate to. So what does he do? He creates this character, Wilson, who I don't know about you, but when Wilson falls off the boat,
oh my God.
I'm upset.
Oh, my God.
It's a volleyball.
Oh, my God.
It's a volleyball. But because we used emotion to it, I'm going, Wilson, no.
Right. And you're like, why am I crying for a damn volleyball? Like, what?
Volleyball.
And that's the brilliance of Tom Hanks. That's the brilliance of Bob Zemeckis. It's just the brilliance of all of that. I mean, how he did not win the Oscar for that performance.
No,
exactly. Jesus Christ. It's remarkable. Now, I have to also ask you another great 90s film that you made, Anaconda.
I know.
I mean, where did that come from? The giant snake movie. It's like it's pre-Sharknado, and it's not nearly as bad, by the way. So please, I'm not comparing them.
No, I know that.
But
Sharknado's fun, man.
They're so much fun. They're so much fun.
It's fun.
But Anaconda, I remember when it showed up, and we're like, well, this is genius. I mean, this is like, why hasn't there been a giant snake movie before?
Yeah, exactly.
Where did that come from?
You know, it was once again the agents called and said, by the way, Sony's looking for a rewrite in this. They said, all right, whatever. So it just sort of dropped in our laps. And it was a very interesting, it was very different than any other film we've done.
Yeah.
One is there, all the CGI was already being done. So the graphics were already being worked on. So we could not change the basic graphic attacks of the snake. But the story, from our point of view, didn't work. The characters didn't work. There was no antagonist in the movie. And so our job was to basically rethink the story of the characters. So we came on board and recreated who the characters were, all new story of why they were going up to the Amazon, what was happening, all the relationships and people. We created all of that material and had to weave it around all the CGI effects.
Yeah, so it's because the attacks were already done. So when you have your cards up on the board, these are the 10, we gotta navigate this.
We gotta make those things happen. So we had to create new characters and new relationships and new problems and different characters being caught by this, obviously, because that's not a problem because it hadn't been cast yet. So that was sort of a fun thing to do. And it was just sort of fun to, to kill people. these strange, bizarre way.
I mean, there's a bit of humor in it, but it is definitely not your typical, as far as your filmography is concerned. It's definitely not Secret of My Success.
It is, yeah. But I'll tell you, it gets from residuals. I can see how many people watch it, and it's still one of the most watched movies done. So it was actually during the pandemic. It was the top 10 of Netflix for 1 week. I was going through my list. I'm going down. Oh, what's the top 10? I go, what? Anaconda is number 9 for the week. Okay.
So, it's like 23 years old. How is that?
Well, it's cast. I didn't have anything to do with casting, and the casting is remarkable.
Oh, yeah. Ice Cube, J-Lo's in it. J-Lo.
Ice Cube. I got to meet Ice Cube years later, and I said, by the way, I'm the guy who stuck you in that swamp with the camera. And he goes, oh, man, you did that.
He did okay. He did okay for himself.
He did well.
He did fine. Now, one thing you've said a lot of, that you did a lot of rewriting, and you worked on you know, massive hits like Sister Act and Die Hard 3. And now that I know that you had a hand in Die Hard 3, it makes sense. Because there's a lot of my two favorite Die Hards is Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 3, with 4 coming up, and then 2 is the last one, and I don't even consider any of the other ones. but 3 was such a wonderful buddy, and talk about conflict. I mean, yeah. Sam Jackson and John McClane, I mean, and Bruce on that was great. How do you approach rewriting a script? Because you've done it so often in your life, and you also have a book called Screenwriting is Rewriting. So I'm sure you have a couple things to say about that.
Well, you know, rewriting is the key. Every writer is going to tell you that. Screenwriting is rewriting. That's where the title came from, because you have to be willing to dive in. You've got to be willing to take notes. And, you know, we become very precious with our material. Mm. We don't want to, you know, make changes. But when you're a professional writer and the studio tells you, here's what we want, you can't, you can argue and get thrown off the movie. That's not going to help you. Or you can stay there and try to protect the movie. And that's what basically my approach is. Let me work with them. Not everybody's an idiot. Let me work with the best I can. Let me work with their ideas. And the key is trying to figure out not just the specific notes, but what are the notes saying in general, and trying to work on the bigger note, which is the response you're getting from people. We always were pretty lucky that that the notes we got were never huge. The biggest note we ever got was from John Landis. When we did the first draft of Dick Tracy, we didn't put Junior into the movie. And his first note was, where's Junior Tracy? And we went, oh, yeah, right. Okay, we got to put Junior Tracy in, which we had to actually start all over again, because that's the core relationship of the movie. Mm-hmm. So suddenly we can't just – what you can't do in rewriting is just plug things in. You have to realize that there's a cause and effect of everything in the screenplay. So if you put something in this scene, it's going to relate to scenes later. And part of that is realizing the way the puzzle fits together and the way that everything sort of works. So we're always approaching – I'm always approaching rewriting as, you know, one, trying to figure out what the assignment is, two, figuring out what the notes are, three, getting a game plan. I'm going to address this in a certain way. I'm just not going to have at it. As a professional writer, I'm trying to save every bit of work I can. So I don't want to rewrite the whole script. A lot of people throw the baby out and they start all over again. No, I'm going to try to preserve everything I can and try to weave it in, the new elements, into this existing story if I can. But also, I've had words changed all the time. So I'm not precious, super precious on things. I'm only precious on things that I know the story has to have. So what's the heartbeat of this story? What's the core emotional moment of this movie about? How does the audience relate to this movie? I'm not going to give that up, because then I'm going to damage the story. So rewriting is about figuring out what's a game plan and then going at it. My approach is to do a series of passes, not to try to do everything at once. I like to do character first. Let's make sure we get this character story really well told and we know who this character is. I like to know what the theme is and my thematic balance. I want to make sure that I understand the plot elements are not only telling a good story, but they're helping reveal the character. And this is really important. Plot reveals character. How a character responds to the plot problem is what tells us a lot about the character. Mm-hmm. And so using my storytelling techniques to tell a story about a life in crisis is what I like to say. Movies are about lives in crisis. So is my character in crisis? Is the crisis substantial? Is it enough to motor a whole movie?
Right, exactly. And well, let me ask you a question, though. When you're working on projects like Sister Act and Die Hard 3, I know a lot of screenwriters don't understand why some people get credit and why others don't, technically on their name on it. How does that work? And can you explain a little bit how the WGA kind of, you know, polices that situation?
Sure. Well, the WGA was founded basically to award credits. That's what went on strike for, because in the 30s, you know, the studios would give credits to their brother-in-law and whoever it was.
Jesus.
And so writers had no say in how they were credited. And that's what the original, one of the original strikes was for. So the DGA and WGA handles all of the credit determination. There's an anonymous arbitration panel that is convened, and they basically read the materials, and there's rules that the guild has laid down on how credit is determined, whether story credit, a screenplay credit, written by credit, the different layers of different credit. And depending upon the work that you've done on the script depends upon what credit you deserve.
So, okay. And so then, all right. So that makes perfect sense. Cause I mean, obviously Sister Act has, and Die Hard 3 both have a lot of your touches. I can sense the spirit is there.
Yeah, they definitely do. And Sister Act is sort of a sore point with me because we were advised not to see credit because the movie was a disaster on the set. And I always felt bad about that because I really liked the script. So then, of course, we went to the premiere, and I went like, well, that was unfortunate because there's a lot on Jim and I in that movie. And we feel a kinship to it. But, you know, that's one that got away. So we're glad that we could basically put so much into it.
I never heard that. I mean, I think I might have heard something in regards to the being a disaster on set, and no one was expecting Sister Act to be a monster hit.
No one was expecting anything.
Right.
And then from the first, I was sitting in the premiere for the first note, I went, a hit. and it was written, it was not written for Whoopi Goldberg. Mm-hmm. Originally, she was a late cast.
Who was he written for?
Well, I'm trying to think of the actress, the Broadway actress. I can't think of it right now.
Okay.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh, she did other movies?
Yeah. I can look it up.
Because now I'm fascinated because I cannot see Sister Act with anybody else other than Whoopi Goldberg.
No, she was the perfect cast. Absolutely. She was a perfect cast. Bette Midler.
Oh, Bette Midler. That would have been an interesting Sister Act. It wouldn't have been the same by any stretch.
No.
But it would have been an interesting.
Yeah, that was for Bette Midler, and she didn't want to do it. She sat about two rows in front of me at the premiere, and I could tell that she slouched. I think she even knew, But Whoopi was the perfect cast.
Yeah.
I think with Bette, I think she would have done a good job. She's a talented actress. It would have been funny. But Whoopi elevated that movie and made it into what it was, what it is. And I think that was a brilliant casting that made it as a standout film and still is.
And now where can people find your book, Screenwriting is Rewriting?
It's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon. You wrote it basically because you wanted to help screenwriters. You wanted to kind of help them in that kind of process. Because rewriting, it's hard, especially when you're not a professional writer and you like become precious and you're like, I can't do this word. And I know Stephen King's like, just kill your babies.
Well, it is. You have to let go. And letting go is really hard. And also how to approach it is hard. Because people get overwhelmed by notes. They get overwhelmed. They don't want to do it. They tend to take it personally. They tend to feel they've lost. You know, part of things about being a writer is the creative people, we have a lot of insecurities. There's a lot of imposter syndrome. And mm-hmm. So now you're rewriting. Oh, they found me out and all this sort of stuff. And it's important for writers to know you're not alone. All writers virtually feel that. And that what you have to realize, it's a process, and that scripts I've written something. It's brilliant. Well, maybe there's some brilliance in there, but right now you got to get to work and make it into a movie and be willing to let go of your darlings and realize that notes and feedback would help you to write a better script. But my book is about how to approach it. How do you approach a rewrite? And it's not easy. And I tell you that you get 100 screenwriters in a room together. They all do it differently. Mm-hmm. So there's no one way to do it. This book presents my way, which is really about organizing. I believe that you organize a rewrite and prepare for a rewrite. If you organize it, then all the sort of what I call the circle confusion of these notes, what should I do? Where's the answer? I don't know what I'm doing. I'm either going to find me out. If you start to put it on paper and you start to organize it into categories, character, plot, theme, scene structure, just relationships. If you start to break those notes down and then address the notes that you're going to, that are most important for you. Oh, okay. These are the ones that start first to lay this thing out. It will get better over time if you're willing to give yourself time, which it's the process, not the product. And that's where young writers have they want the product. And I can tell you that what the advantage of Jim and I having 7 unproduced screenplays is it became the process. We didn't believe there was a product. So, you
know, right. You're just process. Like, apparently our career is just going to be writing stuff that never gets made.
And there are guys who have, as you said, have earned a good living and never gotten a single thing made.
Right. But are super talented writers.
Absolutely talented. And there's no good reason. And my favorite script is it never got produced. And it just, well, there it goes. That's just how it happened. It got close and never got done.
I've read scripts by screenwriters, that I'm like, this is Oscar. This should win an Oscar. Like this is amazing. This is remarkable.
Yeah.
And there's tons of those scripts scattered on shelves in Hollywood from decades and decades. I remember when they went back and they got The Bodyguard and Unforgiven out of the archives and they brought it back out and look, it turned into 2 hits. There's always these. So it's about not only the talent and the skill, but luck and being at the right place at the right time.
There's a lot of luck, but I also think it's staying with it.
Right.
It's just, you know, Damien Chazelle said he had no B plan. You know, there's only an A plan. And that's it. If you're in for it, you're in for it, which means that you've got to be willing to dive in, do the hard work that has to be done. I also, any writer listening to this, find yourself a writer's group. Don't be out there alone. There, no matter where you are, what city you're in, there are people doing what you're doing. Find them, get together, give each other feedback. Your writing support group, it helps. It helps. You have to get feedback. Secondly, you need people just to help keep you in the game, and realize that you will get stronger the more you stay at it. And if you want to become a better writer, learn to be a rewriter, because that's where you get stronger. Because it teaches you how to be a better writer. Because what you find out is, I don't want to rewrite. So I'm going to make sure I have all this shit down right from the beginning so that I don't have to do this next time. So I'm going to make sure my characters have a really good story. They have a really good, strong want. I'm going to make sure that I have great opposition in my story, that I understand, you know, what is driving this movie and what the emotional stake is for the reader and the audience. I mean, those things you've got to have.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What are 3 screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Chinatown. Robert Towne, who I basically interviewed in my book, which was great. Talked about his rewriting process.
Well, that must be amazing.
It really was, because everybody's different. But Robert, he's really opens up and he's an honest guy. It's really amazing. I think that's a great script. An old script, but I love it, is The Apartment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's come up a couple times here. Yeah.
And I say that because, to me, that script had a huge influence on Jim and I, because the character development, the storytelling, the emotion of it, Billy Wilder and ILO Diamond are amazing, just amazing screenwriters. It's always hard to say what is that other one. I'll tell you what's a good one to read, okay? Go look for the first draft of Good Will Hunting, not the one that got produced.
Yeah.
Go read the first draft or the first draft of Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because what you see there are 2 scripts that they don't work too well. They got some real problems, especially Back to the Future. And then you see what they ended up doing through a series of rewrites and needs. It teaches you that those guys, you know, they didn't hit the ball out of the park on their first swing. You know, they barely got to first base. It's I think it's important to read scripts that didn't work, but the movies did, because it shows you, oh, OK, they reworked this. They took the idea and built it out. And then you see what works. Oh, I see why this movie works now. Of course. Yeah. It seems obvious they'd have those elements, but they weren't there.
And that it also gives us
Back to the Future. I don't know if you know it, the ending takes place. They had to get to a nuclear power plant to power the car back to get back to the future. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's this whole big thing to go through this nuclear. There was no clock tower. But Universal said, guys, we don't have the funds for this. We can't do this. We got to do it on the lot. So they looked at the clock tower and they said, all right, well, we'll have lightning hit the clock tower. You can't imagine the movie without it.
Of course.
But it wasn't there. And they basically, you know, they just well, okay, here's how we made it work.
And it gives us hope. When you read scripts like that, it gives us hope as screenwriters and filmmakers. You're like, look, they look like geniuses. And they are in many ways, but they don't, not everyone hits it out. Like, no one comes out of the womb and writes the great American novel or the great American screenplay. It takes work. And even the best ones. I remember Casablanca. They were writing it on the set.
They were writing on the set. Absolutely.
That's and it's exactly. One of the best screenplays ever written. And it's like they were just trying to figure it out. You know, what looks like genius to us was some screenwriters sitting there going, I don't know how we're going to get to the next scene.
You know, I asked Robert Towne, I said, does it ever get easier? And he said, F no. You know, and he, to me, is one of the great screenwriters of all time. I said, Robert, you've written all these great things. Does it ever get easy? He goes, F no. You know, and so, I mean, and that's the truth. It is a hard thing to do. But the most important thing is that, one, you're telling a story you're passionate about. You have characters that have a story. It's a life going on. There's a crisis at the heart of your movie and or your TV show. Why do we care? What's our emotional stake? What does the audience care about? Why is it important for this character to basically achieve their need at the end of the movie, what it is emotionally that they need? Not only just the physical thing that happens, but what does it mean to them emotionally to do this?
Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
I would say that don't be frustrated. It's going to take time. That what you need to do is to read a lot of scripts, see how they work. Make sure you have a support group, a writer's group, so that, you know, you're getting feedback as you're going along. Know when your script is ready. That's a question I get a lot is, when do you know your script is ready? You know, because there's a thing of, I don't want to send it out. I don't want to send it out. I don't want to send it out. Eventually, you have to let it go, which means that you're telling your story as best as you can, or the feedback you're getting from people, and you do need to get feedback. Is it not like to the heart of the story? And then send it out, take the bumps, whatever happens, and then start another one. You have to continue. It's not, I've seen so many people, I have this one idea. No. So my pitching story is, so I go, you know, you're trying to go pitch ideas, right, to get right. sold. So I've got the pitch I want to sell. I walk in there. It's my, you know, my 8-minute pitch. I've got my song and dance routine. I'm doing the whole thing. And they go, what else you got? All right, now I got my 3-minute pitch. All right, here's this one. I really like this one. They go, all right, what else you got? I give them a thumbnail that's 20 seconds. They go, oh, I love that one. You know? I mean, so you just don't know what is going to hit. You don't know what's going to strike the chord.
Right.
But if you write from your heart and you write from your passion, that will come through as a writer. And it's got to be a good read. You know, this is a reading process. It's got to be a good read. And again, Damien Chazelle is listening to an interview he had on Fresh Air. And Robin Gross said, Damien, you did all these sort of horror movies and all these rewrites. What did you learn from that? He said, I learned how to make them turn to the next page.
Great advice. Oh, God.
Is that amazing? I stopped. Amazing. I got chills because I think you say, well, character and this. No, he learned how to hold their attention and make them read to the end. And I thought, that's just brilliant and simple and honest.
That's amazing. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I think understanding character, understanding what character was, and I had a tough – here's a story how I learned the meaning of how to write character and what true character was. Andy and I had sold a Kojak, and we pitched the idea about a cop who shoots his partner. And we wanted to get the screenplay. So we sold the idea for it, right? Okay, they bought the idea. So we kept going and pitching to the showrunner. Okay, here's what the show is. And he goes, nah, I don't like that. We came back. We never got the script. We didn't get it. We watched Kojak. They hired somebody, watched the episode. And it blew me over like a bolt, okay? We were pitching plot. This veteran writer wrote story of a character. And the whole episode was about this character. And about his life and about his wife who was having a drug habit and she was chained to a bed and he was out there and he kills a partner and now his whole life is falling apart. And all we were doing was doing people chasing, running around, shooting. And it's like, no, the emotional core, that's what character is. And that taught me that I need at the center of my stories to have stories about people and lives that we relate to.
Yeah. And I think, and I've said this many times on the show before, is that you remember character. You remember Indiana Jones. You remember James Bond. You might not remember all the details of the plots of those films, but you definitely remember those characters. And that's who we're not emotionally attached to plot. Plot is just a vehicle, in my opinion. You're emotionally attached to character. What happens to them? If they're going to make it, if they're not going to make it, are they going to find love? They're not going to find love. Are they going to beat the bad guy? Are they the bad guy? Whatever that is. That's what you are attached to.
But you still have to have a good plot.
Again, it's a vehicle. It's a vehicle
because it's what pulls us through it. But you know, and you have to have, I say, you know, cool shit happens. You have to, you know, part of it's set pieces. Well, that's sort of it. You know, I'm good at set pieces. I love writing set pieces. They're fun to write. I think it's one of the joys of writing action movies is thinking of big set pieces. And it's hard to think. They're really harder to write than people would think of because it's all been done. You know.
It was a lot easier in the 50s, 60s to come up with these kind of things.
it's really hard to write something new. But if we don't care about that person at the center of it, it doesn't matter what happens. I mean, it's not about the explosions. It's about the person in the explosions. And we're worried, is he going to get out of the explosions? And at what price?
Right. I mean, Jurassic Park is about dinosaurs, but we're not emotionally attached to the dinosaurs. We're emotionally attached to the characters and running around in that park. I think sometimes screenwriters get a little bit too uppity when it comes to plot, like you were just saying when you were pitching Kojak.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, you have a tendency to fall. Well, it's funny because you actually have to pitch plot. It's very hard to pitch character because character development, but you have to have it there and you tell it. And then you got to say, okay, here's the story because they're looking for what are the events and then how this person is woven into the story. But that's pitching, which is a whole different game in itself.
I've had many episodes about pitching just on pitching alone.
It's tough.
It's an art form. It's an absolute art form. And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, three of favorite films of all time. Okay. Well, we already mentioned one, which is The Apartment, because it just, I saw that when I was really young and I never could forgive Fred Astaire, Fred, you know, talking about
it. Yeah, I know. He's
okay. All right. So I love that movie. Again, I like Chinatown for how it works and how it weaves.
Amazing.
It just is one that is, you know, it's got a great sense of place in that. And I'll tell you, a movie that really had a huge influence on Jim and I was The Sting.
Oh, so that makes sense. By Dave that F. makes Ward. Sense.
I mean, and it's because it totally kept you off guard, off balance, expectations. And the movie it tricked you so many times. It was really, and David S. Ward wrote a wonderful script that basically I went to school on. Jim and I, we broke that script down, every line, just the way it was done.
And do you advise that to screenwriters to actually like take structure from other screenplays and just maybe use it as inspiration to, because if it's been not storyline, but structure of like, this happens at this point, this happens at this point, and kind of start off, it's kind of like a roadmap a little bit. And it's going to probably change obviously as you write it, but I've seen a lot of, I mean, if you look at, I've said this so many times, if you look at Fast and Furious, it's Point Break with cars. I mean, that's exactly the same story.
Yeah, no, I think the danger is to make copies.
Right.
The danger is I'm going to make a copy of something because I really liked a lot. Do an homage to it. You can love it and have a feeling and tone of it, but you've got to tell your own story. And yes, you can learn, you know, how we structurally put this type of movie together. What are successful movies? I mean, I like to break down and understand how movies work and you know, what the core of the storytelling is. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. You can go and I mean, all art is referenced from something else, but you want to make it yours. And yours is who that character is. What is the story? What's that emotional relationship going on? Because that then makes it yours. I'm not a big believer that things have to happen on page 30 and page 40 sort of. I don't believe in that. We definitely have a three act structure culture. So it's a beginning, middle, and end. We definitely have a coming out of a first act where a character is thrown into a situation. I believe that I've learned that a midpoint plot turn is really good. If you can have something happen in the middle, it makes your second act easier to write, because as a writer, the hardest place to write is the end of the second act. That's really hard. You know, easy first acts are easy.
Endings.
Acts, endings are fairly easy. If you know, if you set it up well, you can end it. But that big middle is really where it's hard. So you got to keep that middle moving. And that's where you, that's where I use relationship to keep that middle moving.
But Jack, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to the tribe today and sharing your knowledge and experience and your screenwriting journey with us today. So thank you so much, Jack. I truly appreciate it, man.
Well, it's been fun. It's been fun chatting with you. I feel like we've been chatting for a long time. Like I've known you for a while, so I don't know.
Thank you, my friend. It's
pretty comfortable to do.
I want to thank Jack so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe and just reminding us a little bit about those wonderful, wonderful films in the 80s and 90s. Thank you again so much, Jack. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get his book, Screenwriting is Rewriting, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/129. And if you haven't already, head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, find your favorite podcasting platform, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.